6. EG Month. Equatorial Guinea seemed like a place that Gabriel Garcia Marquez had invented, a former American ambassador once remarked. A thumbprint on the west coast of Africa, the entire country consisted of an offshore island, where the capital of Malabo was situated beside a cliff-walled harbor, and a sliver of land on the continental shoreline. It had been one of Spain's few African colonies. In 1968, Generalissimo Francisco Franco, Spain's then Septuagenarian dictator, granted independence to a government led by Francisco Macias Nguema, an anti-colonial politician. Macias turned out to be a depraved mass murderer. He imprisoned, tortured, and killed his opponents by the score. He closed schools, campaigned against intellectuals, and burned boats to prevent his people from fleeing his realm. His security guards executed 150 people in a sports stadium on Christmas Day, while loudspeakers blared, "Those were the days." In Malabo, Macias maintained an active torture chamber in Black Beach Prison. He increasingly walled himself away on the slice of mainland Africa where his Fang ethnic group predominantly resided. He descended into paranoia and lashed out at anyone who challenged him. Roughly a third of Equatorial Guinea's small population would die or manage to escape during his reign. On August 30, 1971, Lannan Walker, a diplomat at the United States Embassy in neighboring Cameroon, telephoned his colleague Lynn Chertleff to report signs of trouble emanating from the nearby American Embassy in Malabo. Walker reported that Al Erdos, the American chargé d'affaires in Malabo, might also be going insane. Erdos had been sending strange cables in recent weeks. Now he had come on the shortwave radio to report on some sort of communist plot involving one of his American colleagues, whom he had tied up in a vault in the chancery. Walker asked Chertleff to fly to Malabo to investigate. The diplomat arrived that evening by chartered aircraft. At the tiny embassy, little more than a rented house, Erdos, visibly distraught, pulled him aside. He announced, "I lost my cool. I killed Don Leahy." He was referring to the embassy's administrative officer. Inside the chancery, Chertleff found scattered papers and spattered blood. A woman's scream called him to an interior room. There he found Mrs. Leahy kneeling over the body of her dead husband. He had been stabbed to death with a pair of embassy scissors. An autopsy showed that Leahy had semen in his trachea, suggesting that love, or sex, had been an issue between murderer and victim. At his subsequent trial in a Virginia federal court, Erdos entered an insanity defense. His lawyers blamed Equatorial Guinea's menacing tropical dictatorship for having driven him mad. The jury convicted him of manslaughter. The case established a tone in U.S. Equatorial Guinean relations that would persist for years to come. The host government accused one of Erdos's successors of sorcery and expelled him. The ambassador in question, John Bennett, had persistently raised concerns about the country's human rights record. The United States shut its Malabo embassy, pleading budget constraints. Thereafter, it serviced Equatorial Guinea by airplane from its embassy and consulate in Cameroon. Equatorial Guinea was perhaps the most politically toxic oil property Lee Raymond had acquired from Mobil. Given Exxon's reserve replacement challenges, it was hard to be picky. Resource nationalism in the Middle East had driven all of the Western majors to Africa in search of bookable reserves. Exxon had had success on its own in Angola, but Raymond was mainly dependent on Mobil's legacy properties if he wanted to share in Africa's emergence after 2000 as an increasingly important oil supplier to the United States. Some of the contracts available to Western oil companies in West Africa, such as in Nigeria, could be restrictive. Equatorial Guinea was a case where the upside was more attractive financially, as it had to be, given that, on the world's political risk charts, the country presented an extreme case of uncertainty. By 2001, ExxonMobil operated oil platforms about 40 miles offshore, where workers on four-week rotations pumped steadily rising amounts of crude, more than 200,000 barrels per day and rising, or about 8% of ExxonMobil's worldwide production of oil and gas liquids that year. Mobil had negotiated a contract with Malabo's inexperienced government, in which it secured the right to recoup its investment expenses from oil sales in the early years of production, paying Equatorial Guinea's government an initial royalty of only about 10%. The principle that Mobil should be able to recover its costs early was typical of deals designed to protect international oil companies from political risk, but the specific terms were favorable. Now oil prices were rising, and the project looked likely to pay off big to both parties. ExxonMobil's headquarters and residential compound in Malabo stood beneath a towering, dormant volcano. A large population of monkeys inhabited the mountain's rainforests. They were shy because humans had long hunted them as food. In the evenings, heavy tropical clouds often skirted the volcano, which had two peaks, like a double-humped camel. Lightning flashes and quiet rumbles of thunder added an air of ominous majesty. The ExxonMobil refuge contained stucco buildings with Spanish red-tile roofs, residences, offices, and recreation facilities, including a swimming pool. It was not particularly luxurious, certainly not as comfortable as the burgeoning Marathon Oil waterfront compound across the bay, which housed more workers than ExxonMobil's did, and had been laid out for tennis courts, basketball courts, squash and racquetball courts, a clubhouse, and a restaurant. At night, Marathon's gas flares and the white safety lights at its liquefied natural gas and methanol plants illuminated the dark water that spread out beneath ExxonMobil's smaller facility.